here. All right. We're studying through the Word. We're in Nehemiah right now. You want to know how we do it? Pick up a bullet and as you lead and ask somebody. Pick up a bulletin when you leave and it will tell you what we're doing, okay? Or ask somebody else how we're reading through the one-year Bible and so forth. So each one of us has at one time or another, have we not, played tug of war? You know the game. You have a long rope. It's one team on one end, one team on the other end. And each team digs in and tries to pull the other team in their direction. We usually play it at all of our picnics because I like it. And when I play tug of war, I always tell my team that it is absolutely crucial to be ready and to listen very closely for the starting whistle so we can get the jump on the other team. Because that way, we have the edge and momentum. And when a team has momentum, they have a better chance of winning. The team that doesn't have momentum has their work cut out for them. The law of physics teach us that it takes little energy to move an object downhill. It takes a greater amount of energy to move an object on a level surface. And it takes an enormous amount of energy to move an object uphill. That is exactly the dilemma that Nehemiah faced at this point in our study in the book of Nehemiah. You've been reading about it yesterday and today, where we are. He had this uphill climb ahead of him. Things weren't going real well for Nehemiah right now. The people were discouraged. His enemies were after him. And the job was more difficult than he originally predicted. He didn't think it was going to be this tough. And it's a lot tougher than he thought. Nehemiah knew that he had to reverse the situation. Because without the enthusiastic cooperation of the people, he could not finish the job. And he understood the absolute power of motivation, of momentum. And he realized how desperately he needed to get it moving in his direction. Verse 6 shows us that the team of builders is approaching a crucial part of the project. Because it says in verse 6, we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height. They're at the halfway point. This is always where the going gets tough. This is where people are likely to throw in the towel and call it quits. When you're halfway through a project, the thrill of beginning a new adventure has worn off, because when it's new, it's, yeah, let's go, this is going to be fun, it's going to be cool, it's going to be great. But you get halfway through the project. The initial rush of adrenaline has subsided, and the reality of the drudgery of just a daily grind has begun to set in. This is when new businesses start to sputter. This is where churches start to stagnate. This is where teams start losing games. When people reach this point, they seldom see how far they've come. They only see how far they have to go. And they look at their objective and they see how much they have to do. And they think, we have worked so hard, and there is still so much to do. Nobody knows what I'm talking about? Huh? But you've been there? A new project, you go, yeah! And then you work on it for a while, and pretty soon you look and you say, whoa, look at how far we have to go. We're never going to make it. You start slacking off. Start giving up. It is not surprising that Nehemiah's people became discouraged. They'd reached the halfway point. The job looked impossible. Plus, on top of everything else, they were having to deal with threats from their enemies. And Nehemiah suddenly found himself in the midst of a very difficult situation. It's at this crucial place that many people drop the ball. Instead of encouraging other people and helping them get back on the track. They think people need to be pushed and prodded and bullied into submission, and the result is that instead of fixing the situation, many people often make it worse. But Nehemiah is not your average leader. He realized that the people didn't need to be beat up, they needed to be built up. He was sensitive to their feelings and frustrations. Now remember, why could he be? Because Nehemiah had been a slave. His countrymen were slaves. He knew what it was like to be treated less than human. Back in Babylon, his job was to taste the king's food before the king ate and to make sure it hasn't been poisoned. Nehemiah knew how it felt to be treated as expendable, because he was. His job was, if they poisoned the king, I'm dead. So the people were getting discouraged. And instead of beating them up and wailing on them, he realized that wasn't good. No doubt he had seen slaves beaten and abused by their masters. Nehemiah didn't want to be that kind of a leader. He wanted to get the wall built. He wanted to maintain a positive relationship with his people during the process. So Nehemiah stood before the people and said what needed to be said. He changed some things that needed to be changed, and as a result, he diverted a major disaster in the workforce. And I was reading that if there were only more people like Nehemiah, if there were only more employers, more parents, teachers, coaches, managers, pastors who could lead like Nehemiah, how did he do it? How did he restore the morale of the group? I can explain Nehemiah's success in two words. He listened. When the going got tough, Nehemiah listened. He paid attention to what the people were saying, and then he took action. A few years ago, Payne Weber employed an advertising campaign that emphasized their ability to listen to the client's needs and custom design an investment package for each one. Remember the ads? How did your broker know that you wanted to retire early? Remember the ad? And the response was, he asked. What Payne Weber was doing is they were selling the idea that Payne Weber representatives listen. See, the ability to listen is so rare. And this major brokerage firm considers it a selling point. Compare the success of that campaign with that of E.F. Hutton. You remember their major campaign, do you? When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. But that campaign didn't work because E.F. Hutton went out of business. Payne Weber realized that investors want to do business with a company who has a reputation for listening rather than one that has a reputation for talking. Here's a great illustration, one that you will all know and relate to. There is a Winnie the Pooh story, okay? One of my favorite, you know, sources that I use, where Pooh eats so much honey, remember, that he gets stuck in the door on the way out of Rabbit's house. Well, when Rabbit and Owl are discussing how they might get Pooh unstuck, Gopher suddenly appears, offering to help. But he says it will cost a lot of money. When Owl asks how much, Gopher gives Owl some mumbo-jumbo about hourly rate, materials, overtime, plus 10%, but Gopher never answers the question. And Owl says, "What's your estimate?" Gopher answers, "Can't give estimates, too risky." Frustrated at Gopher's response, Owl says, "Blast it all." Gopher replies, "Good idea. We'll dynamite and save time." Owl asks again, "What's the charge?" Gopher says, "The charge? About 7/6 of dynamite." Owl says, no, I mean, what's the charge? The cost in money." Gopher says, no charge accounts. I work strictly in cash." Then before he answers Owl's question, he rushes off saying, "Call me, I'm not in the book." Probably all of us have had similar experience where someone knows the words but doesn't get the meaning they hear, but they don't listen. Are you understanding what I'm saying? Hugh Downs tells a fantastic story about listening. He says that years ago, when he was working in radio, when he first started, he was watching an experienced colleague interview a man who had escaped from a Kremlin prison. The man told how it had taken him months to tunnel out. He talked about how he dug and he dug and he dug and he had to eat the dirt that he dug so that he would have room. And he was telling this story when he figured that his tunnel was outside the prison walls. He began digging upward, trying to reach the surface. One midnight, he was finally ready to break through. He tunneled through a wooden platform above his head. He then told the interviewer, "When I put my head through the hole, I suddenly realized that I was right in the middle of Joseph Stalin's office." The man paused. And at that point, the interviewer said, "So, do you have any hobbies?" He wasn't listening. The seasoned veteran wasn't paying attention to the man he was interviewing. And Hugh Downs said that it taught him a tremendous lesson about the art of interview. Listen when people talk. People who listen are far and few between. People who talk, dime a dozen. But people who listen, truly listen, are far and few between. But Nehemiah listened. He was able to restore people's hope and enthusiasm because he listened. He knew their needs because he listened. In the few words spoken in verse 10, Nehemiah heard enough to reverse the momentum because he listened. And when Nehemiah listened, this is what he heard. First of all, the people said, we're in verse 10, "We've lost our strength. We've lost our strength." The people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is giving out." And notice what Nehemiah did in response in verse 13. "Therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the wall, posting them by families." Nehemiah knew that families could work well together. He knew that putting families together would increase morale. It's a fact of life that people work better when they are with people they enjoy, because it gives them a chance to relax and be themselves. Also, since they were now working under the threat of enemy attack, family members were more at ease being near the people they loved the most. And during this time of trial, fathers wanted to work closely with their sons, and brother wanted to be near brother. How did Nehemiah know to do this? How did he know to reorganize the workers according to families? He listened. He listened to the problems and he looked for a solution. See, the people were getting tired. The people were getting discouraged. And he was able to reverse the momentum by making some changes that gave greater consideration to their needs. Second thing he heard them say in verse 10 is, "We've lost our vision." They said, "There is so much rubble, there's so much stuff, there's so much garbage. You know, we've lost our vision." See, they had started out doing this great work for God. They'd reached the halfway point, and now all they could see was the garbage. All they could see was the rubble. And all they could think about was the impending enemy attack. Verse 12, "The Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, 'Wherever you turn, they will attack us.'" See, the people had lost their vision. So what did Nehemiah do? He restored their vision by reminding them that this project was designed for God's glory, and that he is great and he is awesome, and that he has the power to protect his people. Look at verse 14. "I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, 'Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. How did Nehemiah know what needed to be said? He listened. When the people said, there's too much stuff, there's too much rubble, Nehemiah recognized that they had lost their vision. He listened to the problem and he looked for a solution. And third, Nehemiah heard them say, we've lost our confidence. Verse 10 says, we cannot rebuild the wall. The people had lost faith in their ability to finish the project. Notice that nowhere in this passage does Nehemiah lambast his workers. Consider Nehemiah's situation. He was under tremendous stress. There were times when the project looked hopeless to him too. He too was tired. He too could see the mess. He too could hear the enemy's threats. He knew the people were discouraged. When a leader is under pressure, he needs the people working with him to be strong, and Nehemiah's people were letting him down. And when you're a leader and people begin to let you down, the easiest thing for you to do, the easiest thing for Nehemiah to do, would have been for him to yell and scream, threaten and ridicule. Nehemiah didn't do that. Why not? Because he listened to his people. He heard them say they lacked confidence. And he knew you can't restore confidence by insulting people. It seems rather obvious, but it's amazing how many of us forget that when the pressure's on. How did Nehemiah restore their confidence? In verse 14, he reminded them of God's greatness. And he encouraged them, we just read it, to fight for their enemies. And in verse 20, he promised them that they could depend on God's help. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. How did Nehemiah know that the people needed a pep talk, an encouragement, and not a kick in the pants? He listened. I heard a story of a man by the name of Chris Conway, a single parent, the father of two teenage sons. The boys had gotten involved in a youth group at church, and they were very excited and enthusiastic about it. Mr. Conway one day asked them, what do you like about the group? And the older son answered, we can tell the leaders really care about us by the way they listen to us. Well, this surprised Conway, and he said to them, I listen to you. His son said, I know that, Dad, but you're doing something else. All you ever say is yes or no, or I'll think about it. At that moment, Chris Conway decided that he was going to focus on listening to his sons. At dinner each night, whenever one of the boys would speak, he would stop eating, set down his fork, turn to him, and listen. This absolutely revolutionized his relationship with his sons. And since he spent so much time listening at the dinner table, he also lost 15 pounds during the first 5 weeks, man. It's not bad. Most importantly, the average length of their evening meal went from 10 minutes to almost 45. Listening takes effort. That's why lazy leaders don't like to listen. But great leaders do. And followers can tell the difference. Nobody is more persuasive than a good listener. Nobody has more influence than one who listens. Nehemiah faced the problems of low morale and loss of momentum. In order to reverse the momentum, he needed to help them restore their strength and restore their vision, restore their confidence. And please don't think this is a 3-point sermon on how to reverse momentum. That's not what this is. It's a one-point sermon on how leaders can deal with any problem involving other people. And the secret is listen. Listen. Listen to your children. Listen to your spouse. It has been said that the man, when he first falls in love, hangs on every word that his new wife says. And after a few years, he falls asleep while she's still saying them. Okay. You need to learn to listen. In conversation, we need to have eye contact. We need to listen. We need to hear what's being said. We were having a staff meeting not long ago, and all of a sudden I looked around, and I'm laying out stuff, and I'm this, and we have to do this, and this point, and that point. I look around, and there's not a pencil or piece of paper in the whole group. And I just looked at him and says, "You guys are a lot sharper than I thought you were. You're going to remember everything I talked about?" So they all got up and went and got their pens and pencils and started taking notes, man. We need to listen. We have to take notes or whatever we need to do. We need to listen. A lot of problems will be solved by listening. Jump over to chapter 5 real quick. We'll look at a verse there. A couple of verses. So let's start with verse 14. Over from the time that I was appointed to be the governor of the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes' 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. From the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah. Do you remember what Nehemiah's occupation was? I told you a little while ago. He was a slave, a cupbearer to the king. When he arrived in Jerusalem, he became a contractor, a labor manager. Now he's been appointed governor of Judah. I met a half a dozen people that walked in tonight and told me they were running for governor. Okay. But this guy was really appointed governor of Judah. Any yuppie would be impressed with Nehemiah's fast track up the career ladder. Nehemiah wrote the book on upward mobility. There's a principle at work here that cannot be ignored. When an individual surrenders to the leadership of God and seeks to invest his or her life in doing God's work, that person will be promoted. Jesus said, "He who is faithful in little will also be faithful in much." I've mentioned her a lot recently because I just read a whole bunch about her life. I just read a book. Consider Mother Teresa again. When she began her ministry, her ambition was not to win the Nobel Prize. She wanted only to serve the poor and dying in Calcutta. But when you would now, if you would examine her life, it became obvious that in addition to being compassionate, she was also intelligent, resilient, determined, and street smart. And with those qualities, her ministry couldn't help but grow. It was the same way with Nehemiah. He had the characteristics of a great leader. What characteristics? He was a man of integrity. He was a man of compassion. He was a man of prayer. He was a man of action. He was humble. He was willing to give God the credit and the glory. He was able to stand up under criticism. He could endure discouragement, and he had the courage to face adversity. Let a person with those characteristics try not to succeed. They have to. There's another quality I want you to see in Nehemiah. He was willing to take the promotions as they came his way. He wasn't afraid of tackling responsibility. Too many Christians are unwilling to be used because they are afraid to face challenges. I am absolutely amazed at the number of people who, when given an opportunity to be used, respond by saying, "Oh no, I could never do that. Get somebody else." It's amazing. When I ask somebody to do something, I am turned down 9 out of 10 times. "Oh no, Pastor, I can't do that." "Well, I'm not capable of doing that. Maybe another time. Have you ever thought about so-and-so?" "Yeah, but I'm talking to you. Right now, you're a so-and-so, as far as I'm concerned." "Well, let's deal with this." But it's amazing how many, you know, won't you want to use them. God came to Moses and said, here's a neat principle. God came to Moses and said, "You are the one, Mo, I have chosen to lead," he knew him real well, "to lead 2 million people out of slavery in Egypt." Moses taking care of his father-in-law's sheep, man. Do you know how Moses responded? "Yeah, terrific. I don't have to take care of the sheep anymore. Those smelly, yucky things. I'm going to be in charge of 2 million folk." Is that what he said? What he said was, "Not me, Lord. Must be some mistake. Oh yeah, I'm in the wrong burning bush talking. I do that quite often. I just show up at the wrong burning bush and speak, you know." Moses, there must be. That's ridiculous, isn't it? So there must be some mistake. Who am I to do such a big job? And God's response to Moses was so classic, and you've got to get this. The response was, "The important thing is, Moses, is not who you are, but who I am, and I will be with you." So when God calls you to do something, it's not a matter of, "Oh no, not me. I can't do it. Find somebody else. Time out. If you make me do it, I'm going to run away." It's giving God an opportunity to do it through you. It doesn't make any difference who you are. It has to do with who He is. Because God didn't answer him. He didn't say, "Well, let me tell you who you are, Moses. I spent 40 years having you trained in Pharaoh's court. I spent 40 years out here in the wilderness teaching you things." He didn't say that. He said, "Oh, shut up. Let me tell you who I am. I am that I am, and I will be with you." "Yes, sir." So when God calls you to do something, man, let him just, "Okay, whatever you want to do, man." Give him an opportunity to work through you. It's not easy to allow yourself to be used by God, because you find yourself frequently trying to fight off discouragement. Don't you? When you said, "Okay, I'll do it, God," then you start fighting off discouragement. You have to tackle big challenges. You end up working long hours. You become the object of criticism. It's not easy. And for some, it's not worth it. Because all of those things will happen when God starts using you, man. But you know what's more important? Is that one day He will say to you, "You did good, man. Well done. You did what I called you to do, what I told you to do. Now, see what I have prepared for you." And He opens up the part of heaven that He's prepared for you. And He says, "All of that right there, that's yours. And all the stuff you did without because you were doing stuff for Him. All the stuff you weren't able to do because you were busy working in the kingdom. All the stuff you thought you were being shortchanged because you weren't making the money, you didn't make the big bucks, you were working in the kingdom of God. All that stuff is going to pale when He says, let me show you what I made for you." You go, "That's for me? You shouldn't have. I'm glad you did." Let me get real quickly. See, if you want to be used for God, let me just, I don't know if I need to say this or not, but if you're motivated with the idea of making money or getting lots of recognition or bossing people around, then you're in for a tough ride. But if you have the right characteristics, you're motivated by the right things, you can truly be used of God. Let me give you real quickly what it takes to motivate somebody to become the servant God wants him to be. First of all, it takes a love for people. A love for people. Verse 15. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. Indeed, I also continued the work on this wall, and we did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered there for the work. Nehemiah was a great, great leader because he was able to keep his focus on the object. Rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. At the same time, without losing his compassion for people. It all boils down. You know, God wants us to be people, man. Has anybody heard the song I've talked about yet? If we are the body. Have you heard the song yet? What's wrong with you people? Don't you listen to the Christian radio? It's by a group called Creating Crowns. It's a new group. And it's a song that you need to hear. It's just come out, but it's awesome. And it starts out just, in fact, I'm going to sing it for you. Starts out by talking about some girls in the church, and they're giving another girl a hard time, and they don't know how bad they're hurting her, and blah, blah, blah. And then it starts out, if we are the body, then where are the arms that are reaching out? Where are the hands that are healing? Where are the words that are teaching? Where are the legs that are going? And it's incredible. And then the next verse comes in where it's the guy off the street comes into the church, and he sits in the back row, and he looks around, and he sees, as the people look at him, he sees the way they look at him, and he says to himself, this is not where I'm going to get help. I'll get more help out on the street than I will in this place. If we are the body, where are the arms reaching? Where are the hands healing? Where are the words that are teaching? Incredible. And I guess that's what the reason that I really got into that to that song is because that's what I'm trying to see here in this church. If we're the body, then are we embracing people? Are we reaching out? Or are we so concerned with our world that we're not listening? We're not hearing. We're not touching. We're not embracing. I guess the question is, how do you view other people? Are they just an audience to watch you perform, as in our presentation of the Bema seat? And one of the scenes is about that. And he said that I used to view people in my life as just objects that were there to make me look good. When you get a call from someone who needs help, do you really care about them? Or do you consider the call an inconvenience? Great servants and great leaders are motivated by a love for people. By a love for people. Secondly, they're motivated by a love for God. But the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Throughout history, people have abused the power of leadership. Rulers, kings, priests, popes, governors, preachers, lawmen have all fallen prey to the seductive lure of power. Sergei Popov, a former communist, tells about the disillusionment he felt when he got an inside look at the Kremlin and observed the high level of corruption, the extravagant standard of living these leaders enjoyed, the blatant disregard for the hardships their people were living under. Martin Luther expressed a similar disillusionment when he, as a young monk, visited Rome and witnessed firsthand the corruption and the depravity. A few years ago, during the PTL scandal, the public became aware for the first time of the high standard of living many of God's servants enjoyed and the fringe benefits that they experienced. Nehemiah could have taken advantage of his position, but he refused to use his position as a means for personal gain. There are other examples, local examples we could use, but we don't need to. But, you know, you can't do that, man. For every 100 people who can handle adversity, there's only one who can handle power. Power corrupts. I've known people who remained faithful to God during times of trial and then departed Him during times of prosperity. Do you know that not everyone can handle success? For Nehemiah, success wasn't the issue. Serving God was. He loved God too much to abuse His power. Do you understand? It's not a matter of success, it's a matter of serving God. My definition of success is obedience. If I'm serving God, I'm doing what God called me to do. The definition of success for the world is irrelevant to me. It makes no difference. You know, success to the world right now, if you're pastoring a church, if you have a mega church, and you have written books, and you're on television, and everybody knows who you are, you know, I'll tell you what. Been there and done that with that mentality, man. Right after I had my heart surgery, traveled for several months, remember how many it was, and did marriage seminars all over the United States, actually. I'll tell you what, some of the greatest pastors I ever met in my life, because what we did is we wrote a bunch of Calvary pastors and stuff in little churches, because they couldn't afford to have anybody come and do stuff. So we wrote a lot of little churches and said, we would like to come if you would like us to come, and we'll pay our own expenses and travel. We'll everything. We don't want any offerings, anything from you. We just want to go and serve you. And we did that for a while, for several months. And I'll tell you what, I met some of the most godly men I've ever met pastoring churches of 20, 30, 40, 50 people. I met men who absolutely have given their lives to their flock in love and care. I remember I was at church and I got there and small church in New Mexico. The pastor met me at the airport. I'll tell you what, I was there 3 days, 3 or 4 days. I'll bet I didn't sleep 2 or 3 hours a night because he had me going constantly, besides the teaching and the seminars. Now, this couple needs to talk to you. Let's go over to their house, okay? Now, these people, let's go over to their work, because you need to talk to them. And these people, you need to go reach. And I'm telling you, man. On time I got through, but it's because he had genuine love and concern for his people. And one of their needs met. It was incredible. And yet the people loved him so much. They could tell how much he loved them. This man wasn't getting rich in the ministry. His wife worked. He had a part-time job with the police department. He loved on his people, man. And I met pastor after pastor after pastor, you know, that was like that. Never taking advantage of their position. A third motivation for serving is a sense of eternity. And this is it. This is the last one. Throughout history, those who have done the most for this world have been those who were most concerned for the next world. An eternal perspective affects the way you live your life. It affects the big decisions. It affects the little decisions. Your perspective of eternity. Not just mouthing it, but really having a sense of eternity. It'll affect, if you have a sense of eternity, it will affect how you earn your living. It will affect who you marry. It will affect how you treat your neighbor. It will affect how you spend your leisure time. It will affect how you spend your money. And on and on. A person with a sense of eternity will truly make a difference in this world. Nehemiah understood that this world is not all there is. He realized that he was working for an eternal purpose and for an eternal reward. And in his prayer he said, verse 19, "Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I have done for these people." Someone once told Mother Teresa, "I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million." She replied, "Neither would I." She made a difference in this world because she had a profound sense of the eternal. She wasn't doing it for $1 million. She knew eternity. This should be our motivation as well. The word is very plain. The Bible is very plain. This world is not our home. Our real home is in heaven. And this life is just preparation for the next. We're through. I just want you to look up three verses with me real quick. 1 Corinthians 2:9. You need to see them. 1 Corinthians 2:9. But as it is written, you got it? 1 Corinthians 2:9. As it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. How about just back one book, go to your left, and go to chapter 8 of the book of Romans, and find verse... Boy, that's hard not to touch that, isn't it? We didn't hear anything. Okay. Romans 8:18. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Romans 8:18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Now one more, John 14:3. We're going to close with your song in a couple of minutes, but Kelly, cue up I Can Only Imagine, would you? John 14:3. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. What motivates a servant? The recognition that God is eternal, and people are eternal, and it's up to us to make a difference in eternity. You understand what I just said? A real servant is one who recognizes that God is eternal and people are eternal. That none of us will ever cease to exist. It's just a choice of where we're going to spend that eternity. Am I right? And if we really believe that, we'll be doing everything we can to make sure those around us will spend eternity with the God who is eternal. One of the dear saints of this church, this has been a tough, tough year, man. One of the dear saints of this church just went home to be with the Lord unexpectedly. Been around here forever, Priscilla Wade. And she's experiencing eternity right now. Stand with me, would you? She was always busy about her father's business. She wasn't bashful about her witness. Wasn't ashamed. Let's sing I Can Only Imagine first. You can't?